Welcome to the Farms Vice Agribusiness Podcast, where we talk about how to grow your agribusiness through efficiencies and lifting your productivity. I'm your host, Jack Creswell, and on this week's episode, we head into number 58 as we dive into another fantastic value-adding farm based near Tullamore, Central West, New South Wales. It's called Outback Lamb. If you haven't heard of it, look it up. It's a great business, and it's led by the key driver, Fiona Aviot. Just around the corner from the Farms Vice studio, actually, which we both only just learned. How funny is that? A huge fan of these sort of value-adding into existing farming frameworks and how that can both benefit the consumer and also the farmer at the start of the supply chain. They both come out with a win with new products for the consumer and increased revenue for the farmer by supplying the high quality product. Let's dive in and see how it all began for Fiona and the team. Fiona, how are you going?
I'm well, thanks, Jack. How are you?
Really good. Great to have you on and introducing what you get up to within agriculture. But before we get down to your agribusiness, can you just give us a bit of an overview on what your connection is and what your background is before we get into it?
Yep. So I grew up in the Tullamore Peak Hill district and went to primary school in Tullamore. We're fifth generation farmers on the, you know, same or similar country that my ancestors settled on in 1886. I went away to boarding school, did a year at Hawkesbury Ag doing systems ag, and then transferred to Orange and did a Bachelor of Business in Ag Comm there. Had a couple of years overseas, did the, you know, bit of a stint. I went for 3 months and ended up staying nearly 4 years. So, and then came back to the farm. I'm one of four. And my sister Felicity, who's younger than me, has ended up on the farm, and myself, I have a sister who lives in Orange and a brother in Dubbo.
Great stuff. And before, if anyone doesn't know where Tullamore is, it's Central West, New South Wales, isn't it? Just around the corner.
That's right. Yeah, exactly right. Bang. It's all really pretty traditional mixed farming country with, you know, around that 500 mil rainfall and no irrigation or anything.
Yep.
It's all dry land.
Yeah, excellent. So you went overseas. What did you go overseas for? Because I did a very similar thing. Thought I'd go there for 6 months and nearly 4 years later.
Yeah, well, we grew up with horses coming from like that particular area. My background was trotting, but we're always been tied up in picnic racing and that sort of thing. And when I was at Hawkesbury Ag, I did a bit of work at the racetrack there for a trainer. And when I wanted to go overseas, I organised to transport horses out of Melbourne into Asia, and then was going to do a stint in Ireland with at Coolmore Stud, just doing yearling prep, you know, mucking out stables and really like bottom level kind of stuff. And then I just fell in love with Ireland and the experience. I think it's a bit like when kids here go up north. It's that first time you're making, you know, fair money, and there's a heap of young people around, and it was a time when historically, like they say now, the Celtic tiger roared. That was they'd come out of a period of massive unemployment and just, you know, were booming, and just great fun, and there's so many opportunities, and one thing led to another, and I just used it as a base and then traveled around a lot. I spent a bit of time in the Middle East and traveled through Europe, and I'd come back and do yearlings or foaling or, you know, different things like that, and just felt I could have stayed there forever. But got to 26 years of age and I was like, oh my God, everything I own's in a rucksack. I've got to get back to the farm. So I did.
Yeah, that's it. You get sick of living out of a bag, don't you? For sure.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, I don't know what it is. Like, you just have to, I loved it, but there's nothing quite like putting down roots and certainly doing something you love. And I was always, you know, if I could combine horses and farming, that's what we'll definitely do.
Yeah, definitely. I think, like, as growing up in agriculture, you always have that tie back. Whether you want to come back or you don't, you still feel connected to agriculture as a whole. for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. They're very much a connection. And we grew up, I was always much more interested in being outdoors than indoors. It was, you know, it was very hands-on. And my brother, he was home as well, and just he'd done a stint at Orange Ag, and just kind of was, as he was growing up, realized it probably wasn't for him. And my other sister, Felicity, she went to Gatton. So we're all interested in agriculture and, you know, just putting down those roots close by. So it was just kind of a natural. I didn't grow up thinking I'd be on the farm, but I always knew I'd be involved in agriculture.
Yeah, beautiful. And now let's get down to agribusiness. Great to see a bit of your background. Outback Lamb, this is your venture. When did it start?
Yes.
And most importantly, how did it start? What was behind it to kick in the butt to get it going?
It was a really slow burn. I think we thought about it for quite some time, but the catalyst for me was it was kind of like farmers not being able to, getting such a bad rap in the media, to be honest, in terms of it always, every time I opened the paper or turned on the news, it felt like we were being shown as these environmental vandals or cruelty to animals. It was all negative about mulesing and different, you know, it just didn't matter what it was. We were just getting a bit of a flogging, and environmental. And as you would know, and as I know, that's absolutely not the case. Like, it's just, you know, farmers are so concerned about everything and prioritize their animals. And there's always exceptions, but just the, you know, 99% are just so amazing. And so I was really thinking, it's such a, we have to start telling our own story and not letting that void be filled by people who had a different agenda, like maybe Peter or the, you know, vegans or the greenies or all that sort of thing, who were telling this story that what I was reading in the news and that just never seemed to really represent us and what we were trying to do. And we just started, it was a crazy time to try to value add to Outback to Lamb because it was the drought and there were short supply and the values, you know, were going up anyway. But I could see we were just a little bit jack of the whole, we'd been expanding the farm, we'd been really concentrating on our genetics, pushing livestock and looking at ways to, you know, stay viable, I guess, and really try to succeed. And it was, everyone likes to wax lyrical about the farm lifestyle, but the novelty was wearing off a little bit. We were just working so hard all the time. And then it was the drought, of course. And I remember that in the Telegraph was interviewing this lady who had moved all the potty lambs into a house, and they, you know, were doing a fundraiser to get them new carpet because the carpet had been ruined. And I just thought, it's just so not representative of ag and what actual farmers do and who lives, how we live and what we're trying to achieve. So we started Outback Lamb, and I just thought, well, we'll do it through social media. And we started off doing boxed lamb with a little farm shop, and then moved very quickly into wholesale. And then I was lucky enough to participate in a accelerator program called Farmers to Founders with Sarah Nollett and Christine Pitt. And so we focused very much then on, we stepped away from the whole bodies and really concentrated on doing the lamb sausage rolls and lamb pies as a value add. And that's where we're at today with Outback Lamb.
Fantastic to hear. And how did you actually come up with Outback Lamb? Did you dwell on the name, or you just went, went with it?
No, I did. I'd been talking to some friends in Hong Kong who were really keen to get some Australian lamb, you know, into their business, and because they were had a little shop and they were selling anything Australian was just going for ridiculous money. And I, you know, being incredibly naive as you are when you start something like that, I was just like, well, surely I can get a contract kill somewhere and box on up and send it over. And clearly, as no doubt you're aware, it's much harder than that. But so we kind of, I always started with a view to doing export, and I didn't want it to be something that would disappear into consolidated revenue. It had to have an entity of its own. And I sort of without really doing a business plan as such. I had it this innate sense that it needed to have its own identity, and we had to be branded, and we really had to market ourselves in order to tell the story well and target an audience and a consumer that would be interested in the product.
Yeah, and I think you can start to connect with the consumer itself when you're going direct, can't you? Whether you're doing wholesale or direct to customer.
Yeah, and it did surprise. That was one of the biggest surprises we'd had. So in the beginning, if you'd asked me, you know, often in marketing stuff, they ask, who's your avatar? You know, who's your customer and that type of thing. And I would have absolutely said, you know, Bondi, Eastern Suburbs, foodie who's right, wants to be more connected to the source of their food and all that sort of thing. But what we found really early on was easily 80% of our stuff was within a 300 kilometre radius of what we were doing. We were selling heaps into Dubbo, heaps into locally, condo parks and Orange. Like that's where the majority of our product was going.
Yep. Do you see that's because consumers want to support local rather than the Bondi hippie wanting to know where his food's coming from?
I think it is. I've felt unbelievably supported by community and customers because I think they love the concept of what we're doing. And I'm pretty sure most farmers, and again, I'm sure you're not the same, we all feel innately that we're on the cusp of some real changes in ag, and I'm not quite sure where it's going, but I know that it's not going to be the same as 10 years ago. And so I was sort of casting around for that new thing, and I wanted to be running, you know, less sheep, but making more money and yep. kind of really being able to look after the land a lot better. And just not, I always felt like, we run merinos and crossbreds, and the crossies get the sort of premium paddocks, you know, the merinos tag along behind. Yep. And I always feel like they're so highly productive, particularly the merinos. They're cutting so much wool, they're having, you know, multiple births, and they're a bit like a big dairy cow. Like they're only two mouthfuls away from metabolic collapse. Like there's so much management that goes into running a high performance animal. And I'm very conscious of the fact that we live in a 500 mil rainfall area that can be highly productive when the rain comes, but isn't otherwise. And yep. I've just found myself questioning our farming model and what we were trying to achieve, and just really wanting to tweak that in terms of, you know, for the next generation, I guess, and saying, well, you know, I have to farm like it's a 500 mil rainfall and that we're in a warming climate and that we're doing things differently. And how might I do that? And Outback Lamb sort of feels, is part of that picture.
Yeah, of course. And I suppose it's bringing it down to a manageable and controllable level for your farming enterprise there, whoever's working on that within the family. Do you feel like you've gained a lot more control on what you're doing when you started to value add?
So a lot more control over who's like buying the product
If you're reducing your numbers, but you're also increasing the profits that you can, or generating the revenue from value added products. Do you think that like managing smaller mobs of sheep and allowing that soil to regenerate itself allows you to focus on what the real core focus is?
Well, I mean, it's all, let's just say it's all in that heavily experimental phase, but yep. I think I find with our crossbreds that they eat as much as a small bullock. Like they pump out a heap of lambs, there's no question about it. Like you're usually getting, depending on the season, between 140 and 160%, and we were always targeting the big heavy export market and growing grain and putting it into them. And you know, we were successful at what we did in terms of finances, but just in terms of our quality of life and the workload and what we were achieving, I was questioning that and the longevity of it, like how long that model was going to be sustainable. Yep. And so part of us getting the ProBreed, those smaller Highlander ewes is a bit of an experiment. We've got 340 or 50 of them, and they'll be highly productive. They'll have a lot of lambs, but we'll really use them to target the domestic market and, you know, put off, instead of putting off a 60 kilo lamb, really try to put off something early at, you know, 40 kilos and maybe not carry them as long and not have that heavy, just that high production. Like it's, I just don't know if it really is suitable for what I'm trying to do.
Yes. Suppose what you're trying to do is look for, are you trying to look for a more rounded sort of lamb that can go to market?
Yeah, so for the Outback lamb sausage rolls, we obviously we want to get more weight into them. So yes. We'll often use the Merino lambs are quite good for that as well. And our better crossbred lambs are going into like Bourke Street Butchery and that, you know, they're a more visual, smaller, you know, that sort of 22 to 26 kilo sort of weight dressed and more for a domestic market. And that's what we'll do with the pro breed ones, that they will meet a specific market. Whereas definitely to do the sausage rolls, we want a lot of meat and, you know, maybe we'll go into Dorpas because it'll be, but it's about, just doing, it's a whole picture, I guess, is what we're looking at. So how can we incorporate, we did some early work with Farm Lab looking at carbon measuring, how what we might change and moving away from those really big gutsy first cross ewes is our first step because they are, you know, quite hungry all the time.
Yeah, definitely. They really are. And trying to keep that up to them to the standard so you can get that dress weight 22 to 26 range.
And you can finish them like with grain. Like that's it's like we can all grow a, you know, crop competition winning crop. Like you Longfellow and you clean it right up and you, like we can all finish sheep and the prices have been excellent. Like there's no doubt about that. But in terms of what we want to do as producers, like I really want to grow grass-fed lambs and I want to have strong pastures. I want to have the most nutritious lamb we can produce as well. It's something that I'd like to grow, eat myself, rather than having, I see Australia following time and time again an American model where we're pushing towards a heavily industrialised system. We all use, feedlots or drought lots or containment feeding really and really well to save pastures. There's definitely roles for it, like don't get me wrong, but I don't want to go right down that American path because we've got so much more to offer Australia and New Zealand in terms of doing more that regen style of production and hopefully getting a premium by doing it, but it really trying to explain that to the customer.
Yeah, I think that's the way that you got to sort of differentiate where you tell your own story. It all encompasses, like Woolworths isn't saying what sort of soil their lamb or beef was grown on, are they? That's up to you to try tell that story and really connect to the consumer and the land.
And we have to remember, like we're growing food for an increasing world population. Like all the figures that I see, most of us have to, that are landholders already and producing food, have to increase what we're doing by about 45% by 2050 in order to be making the product to feed that growing world population. So it's, you know, what I'm doing isn't the right way for everyone. Does that make sense? Like it's not,
totally.
We do have to feed people and whether that's with alternative proteins, whether that's with like, combinations of alternative proteins and meat or looking at lots of different things about people growing more intensively like mushrooms and all that sort of stuff a bit closer to the city again, even though they, you know, sold all that dairy farm for housing. It's all, you know, there'll be lots and lots of changes and I don't really know what the path is, but it's this is the path we're sort of choosing for ourselves.
Yep, well, it sounds like a great path that you got yourself on and you're only really just at the beginning of what's about to happen. The bit of a change in what consumers want, and it's pretty important for us as farmers to listen to that as well.
100%. Look, and it's funny because we've got merinos, like, so non-mules is a big thing in the merino industry. And it doesn't matter what I think, it doesn't matter what you think, it doesn't matter what any other farmer thinks. That's like, you know, I always say that somewhere in Alaska, there's a couple of baby seal clubbers going, you know, geez, that was a terrible choice we made a few, you know, back in the 80s, because they, I'm sure they were like us. They were like, look, you don't understand. We manage our environment. We know what we're doing. We don't kill all the seals. It's, you know, really manageable, blah, blah, blah. And to them, it wasn't that terrible. But at the end of the day, the consumers completely dictated where that industry ended up, because you know, you just couldn't buy a fur now, I don't think, and yeah. You lived in Alaska. It's just, so we really have to understand that it is a consumer market. Like, we're growing wool to sell, and it's, we have to grow the kind of wool that people think they want to buy. The consumer isn't always right, but it doesn't matter. So we're non-mules now, but it's, you know, taken us a while to get there. And this will be our next clip will be our fifth clip of non-mules. And I hate saying that a lot of the time, because it makes me sound like I'm anti-mulesing, and I'm not anti-mulesing, but I understand very clearly, I think, that the market will demand that in a very short amount of time. And we've got the technology, and the, so many people are working towards the genetics to get there. So we might as well just all get on board.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the early adopters are rewarded with that risk that they take early on. That could literally be another episode, just seeing what the consumer tastes are in Aussie products, Aussie farming products. But let's get into what your supply chain, like your production, looks like. How many steps does it take until it's all boxed up? Are you doing anything on farm?
No, I don't do any on farm. So we process either at Ningen or Cowra, depending on where, like what our kill is that week for.
So you're doing a weekly like kill?
Butchers. We usually, when we're busy, we're doing weekly. We're doing fortnightly at the moment. So it just kind of just depends on the numbers. But yeah, so we process, and then it all goes back into Dubbo to Bourke Street, and they break down the carcasses and stuff for me. We've got markets for shanks and ribs that go into food service and restaurant and that kind of thing, pubs, and then we literally just dice or mince the rest of it, and it's all going. We did for a while. We used to pull the saddles out for food service in Sydney, but we stopped with COVID last time and didn't really rebuild that market. And then we either bake so that it goes to condo to the bakery there, or else we go to, at the moment I'm doing a collaboration with a pastry chef in Sydney called Christopher T, and he's quite renowned in that pastry sort of area for he started Black Star Pastry quite a few years ago, which is a bit of a chain now, and he sold that, and now he has another business called This Is Us, and they do a lot of the baking for Harris Farm. He does muffins and crumpets and all that sort of stuff, and I'm collaborating with him to do sausage rolls that to go into a retail market and also into food service, like some bigger buyers. And that's, we're got a launch scheduled for that in early September at Fine Food Australia.
Yep.
And so that's been an exciting collaboration. I really look forward to getting the product into retail markets.
Yeah, that sounds fantastic. You're really leaving no punches unthrown there, getting into the likes of Harris Farm markets and also working with what the end product it was with the pastry chef. That's a pretty cool thing. Do you think that
he's really cool? Like, he's so passionate about the provenance of food and you know, where it comes from. He uses all the single origin flour out of from around North Star and Mullally up there, and he uses the Pepe Sayer butter, and so it's a really, and I'm very conscious of not making a, you know, silk purse out of a sow's ear, because it is a sausage roll, but it's a really premium quality, and hopefully will be really well received in that Harris Farm and sort of gourmet market.
Yeah, beautiful. And for like anyone looking to diversify and do something like what you have, whichever sort of animal livestock they have, you are using the whole carcass, aren't you? Because that can be the most difficult thing, is where to market the whole carcass. People love the ribs, the rump.
Yeah. We've been really lucky with the weight, the numbers that we're doing. So it's the ribs and the shanks like fit the existing markets, or we've been able to grow those markets to fit the numbers that we're processing. And it all seems to be working out quite well. Like there was a stage where we were eating a lot of shanks at home and you know, it was and we did eat a lot of saddles as well for a while when COVID kicked off and they weren't cooking in the restaurants, but it was, you know, it's all the numbers are working really well. My goal is to have access to our own on-farm processing, or you know, maybe in at parks with their inland hub, they want to do something there as well. So and really find a market for the skins and offal and that type of thing, because I see a real opportunity there that I can't access at the moment because we don't control that end of it.
Yep. Well, I think that's an exciting thing where you can branch out and sort of grow and further value add to get the most out of what your product is, raising some quality lamb here in the Central West, of course. For like other farmers, how important do you see diversifying your farm is? This is a big project for yourself, but do you think it should be encapsulated into everyone's farm?
I think we all have to look at it. Like it's, you know, it's pretty, people are pretty, that are farming now are all pretty successful at it. You know, like they know what they're doing and, but it's hard to, the trick is imagining what it might look like in 10 or 20 years time and what our markets might be then. And I think that it's going to be everyone. I would like to see a scenario where we're paid for carbon production and that comes into our, you know, like if we're mixed farming with wheat, sheep and carbon. And I think that would be an ultimate win, because how great would it to be being paid for something that you get to then reap the benefits from your animals eating it and being able to produce really nourishing food and the best, you know, to be paid to improve your soils is, I think, the ultimate and a win-win for everyone from the consumer through to like health department and a million, like I just think it's really, it would have such beneficial flow on effects and not just, you know, not just for people, but for the planet, like it would really work. But, you know, we're a little way off that, but it's, that's what I'd like to see. And I think for most of us, if we do some, you know, early measurements and try to get a bit of a feel for where we're at with our existing carbon and where we can improve and do things. And this was, you know, changing our breeding was one way that we thought we might be able to tweak that and maybe run a few more sheep, like put off, hope what my goal is to put off a similar amount of kilos, but a different type of sheep than what we were producing before.
Yeah, great stuff. For yourself, like as you are doing this, moves into my next question of like being paid as farmers for the carbon. What sort of data are you collecting on farm? Are you collecting data on farm?
So we just did a really simple project with a group out of Armidale called Farm Lab, where they basically use, I don't know, magic and algorithms to, and historical data to assess what your carbon levels are. And I think there's been a lot of research like out of University of New South Wales and that sort of thing into historically how that works. And they're looking to get, you know, a lot more information, but it seemed the data we collected was very, you know, if you'd asked me what I thought our carbon levels were, I would have said, you know, 1.3, 1.4, you know, something like that, like a little bit better than average, but nothing sensational, like, but really representative of our area. And what's the better stuff? Well, you know, 1.8, 1.9, and what can we go to? And so we worked with Farm Lab to sort of do a big, and we're getting over a little bit of country between all of us, and so my dad and my husband and my sister and I. So we just measured over the whole lot to get a really good picture. And there's definitely some room for improvement, but we're traditional mixed farming as well. So it's not it's not as easy as going all regen, because we're still cropping, and it's, you know, we're just doing, maybe we might plant out some more trees or do that type of stuff. We'll definitely fence off some dams and do a lot more watering. There's a lot of things that we can do that will have an impact on carbon and animals and pastures and all that sort of stuff. We'll have maybe a lot more exclusively pasture paddocks, where we'll, you know, hopefully get some established
you'll get some depth in your pastures
anyway. Yeah, exactly. Yep.
Yeah, it's definitely not a overnight success. Like, it does take a few years to develop these pastures in order to have them as well established that they're not going to get chewed out overnight as well. It can take 10, 20 years to really get that in there, get that seed bank growing.
Exactly. It is a big process. And we're, you know, you would have been the same as us. The drought was pretty, you know, there was a lot of dirt blowing around.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually missed that though, because I was over in London. But yeah, my family went all through it. So fortunately for me, I missed it, but now I'm just back into the good season now. But for yourself at Outback Lamb, what's your roadmap? You've discussed a little few little points, but where do you want to see it to go in the next 10 years?
Well, I set myself some goals this year, because if you'd asked me previously, like, what we were, I would have said, look, we're a slightly profitable side hustle. It's so I set myself some goals this year to, you know, go big or go home. I want to sell a lot of sausage rolls, and getting into retail and food service is a big part of that. And collaborating with Chris from This Is Us is definitely a big part of that as well. We've got a great relationship with Ben, the baker out of Condo, and we'll continue to do the pies and everything with him. And it's all been amazing. But this next step is sort of, you know, essential for us in order to get where we want to go. And I'd like to think that I did a stint in Taiwan just pre-COVID, and we did some early market research there with the MLA about how pastry stuff might work in the Asian market. And I think there's probably some opportunities there, but I do struggle sort of with the idea of moving food a long way. But as Australians, we're all mass exporters, so I've just got to get over that.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really backing what you're doing. I really think the lamb industry needs to one up themselves and give it to the beef industry. Not like competing with them, but just to put it at the front of mind for the consumer. We can have a lamb pie, lamb sausage rolls, everything like that, where beef is.
Absolutely. The problem, like with lamb, it's really, it is, and I always have to be highly apologetic. Not to be apologetic about it. It is a really premium product, and you don't get a lot of kilos of meat off a lamb carcass. So it's important that you value that properly. And the irony isn't lost on me that we are trying to step away from a commodity producer into an industry where suddenly I'm a commodity producer of sausage rolls, because it is essentially the key is numbers, because the product is really expensive to make, and it's, you know, it just, that is what it is. But there's so many opportunities in the meat industry, like even with lamb, and we all have to open our minds a little bit to the possibilities of collaborating and working with alternative protein people and all that sort of stuff, because there is going to be a massive demand for, like, when we're all competing in the same space, but we should work together. That's what I'd like to do in the next 10 years, is definitely do a combined lamb and alternative protein product, and looking at, you know, ways that we can feed a growing world population, but with, like, we don't have to, we know meat's a superior product, there's no question about it, but we can also work with our competitors to make a product that's really delicious as well.
Yeah, definitely, I agree with that one. I'm backing it. But for anyone out there that wants to find a sausage roll, where can we find you, sausage roll or any Outback Lamb products?
Well, very, very soon we'll be hopefully in retail. This will, you know, early September is the launch date. And in the meantime, at the Condo Bakery in Condobolin.
Yep,
and he does a lot of orders and that sort of stuff for pie drives and all that sort of thing. So they, for, you know, a great part of the Central West. So they certainly keep us busy. He punches out hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pies every week.
Absolutely. And it's great to connect with your community as well, just to see where it can all go. And moving on, how can someone find like an element within what you're doing and use it as a piece of farms advice? What would you give to someone as a piece of farms advice?
Look, I think that in every farm, there's the opportunity to value add. Like I see it as a real a means of succession planning for the next generations. I think that we've just got to not be afraid, you know, not be afraid to try new things. And certainly for us, we've been in our area, there's a lot of little soldier settlers blocks, and we've been expanding and getting bigger, and that's what we thought we had to do. But now I think there's lots of other ways that you can. We've got a lot of acres, and we don't have to, you know, farm intensively, but we can definitely achieve some value through some vertical investment in our properties.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's a bit more about optimizing and not scaling to ridiculous levels where you can't manage it correctly. If we can all optimize and bring our efficiencies up, the industry as a whole will improve as well.
I think that's 100%. That's a really great way of saying it. Like, it's optimizing and just doing the very best you can with what you've got.
Yeah.
And remembering at the end of the day what we do, like, we're not producing a commodity. We're producing food that nourishes people. And that's everything that we do is really geared towards that, about making it, you know, as nourishing as it possibly can be.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. As long as we can be transparent is what I'm trying to push on the podcast with that. But it's been great for you to come on and be transparent about what you're doing about Backland and your journey. It's great to see you just around the corner. We'll have to pop in very soon to see what you're up to.
That'd be great.
But for anyone in the industry that you would think would be great for the Farms Advice podcast?
So I am always really interested in producers that are doing that value add kind of thing. So when we did the Three Farmers Freight little truck, I worked with Angus Morris, who's got Farmer Brown's Happy Hens, and they're at Geary, and they basically, on top of their existing farming enterprise, run, you know, a whole heap of hens and do the eggs and that type of thing. And so I think he'd be really interesting to talk to. And another person that's doing a value add that I always watched with interest to see what they're doing is a girl called Pip Lawson. And she's out of South Australia, and she's doing red lentil flour. And it's been really interesting as well. She's called the Pinaroo Farmer.
Oh, yeah, I have heard of her, actually. I think it's cool how we're starting to connect their own products and value add to them. And a really exciting space looking in the next 10 years or so. It's great to have you.
Don't you think?
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt. I was going to say that, like Australia, we haven't been farming for very long. So I imagine that we will end up a little bit like France or Europe, where, you know, regions will be recognised for certain stuff that they produce, like as we specialise and really fine-tune what we're doing, and whether the Central West is for lambs and, you know, oranges for high-altitude wines and mudgies for red wines. And, like, there's so much, you know, the Southern Highlands for cattle, or, like, there's so many areas that can be really specialised to what they're growing.
Yeah, definitely. And I think starting to connect the communities and what surrounds them as well is another exciting space where the councils, I suppose, have a lot of work to do with connecting that as well. We're part of the cities that we surround as well. So that's a great point as well.
Yeah, just being part, really connected to your environment and knowing what's really well suited, you know, merino wool, and there's just so many great, I mean, we can grow anything in Australia because of the climate, but maybe the climate is going to come against us at some point. I don't know. Maybe, you know, there may be tweaks that we can use to our advantage, but who knows.
Yeah, but I'm sure Aussie farmers will be able to adapt and adopt to what's coming up, whether we can see it or we can't. It's been beautiful having you on today, Fiona. Thank you very much for coming on. How can we reach out to you, get in touch with you, maybe contact you?
Yeah, just through the webpage, outbacklamb.com.au, I use social media quite a bit as well. So I mainly hang out on Instagram, but I love LinkedIn and Twitter as well.
Beautiful. Thank you very much. If you're keen to get in touch with Outback Lamb, and tune in for some sausage rolls very soon.
Yeah, how exciting.
Thanks for tuning in to episode 58 with myself and Fiona from Outback Lamb. And to Fiona, thank you for your time and being so transparent into what you do at your own operation and passing on some information for other farmers out there to see if they can implement it. If you take something away from this episode, make sure you act today. Today is the best time to take action for your own enterprise and use it as motivation to drive your agribusiness. If you did like this episode, please share it on your social media accounts or even mail it to your pen pal. Help us grow and support Australian farmers to become the best they can be, just like Fiona and the team. It really helps us to reach more farmers out there, but we've got 314,000 more to go to reach our goal. Until next Tuesday, keep on farming. Thanks for sticking around right to the end of this episode. If you'd like to become a part of the Farms Advice community, search for Farms Advice Australia on Facebook groups. Connect with others within the industry and become a part of an innovative farmers group, pushing the dial to make agribusiness better. See you next time.